Hi there. This is Jonathan Last sitting in for Charlie Sykes. Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I am joined today by my colleague Jim Swift and my erstwhile colleague Christine Rosen, now of Commentary Magazine. Christine, I haven't seen you since we were all fired together. How are you?
Well, I am doing well, except for the occasional flashbacks to that day. I'm very glad to be here among friends. And
you've gone to a better place. Commentary, my favorite magazine. Commentary has long been, I would say, for the last 7 years or so, Commentary has been like my three desert island magazines. It has been on there. It's what John has done is fantastic. What you are going to be doing with them is fantastic. I love Abe. I love Noah. I just love everybody up there.
It's a great group. I'm really lucky to be there, and we have a lot of fun. We also podcast too. So it's
people listening to this show, which is, we have actually pretty big listenership, should go and subscribe to Commentary Magazine, because this is all free. The Bulwark, we just give you the Bulwark for free. So you can go and spend that money that you might otherwise spend on sort of fine subscription content with the Bulwark. Instead, subscribe to Commentary. You can go to commentary.com and get a digital subscription for $19.99.
CommentaryMagazine.com.
CommentaryMagazine.com. Oh, sorry. Mm-hmm. CommentaryMagazine.com. Or you can get for, what's the price point? Because we have the full thing where you get the beautiful monthly mailbox in your magazine.
Right.
And it's $30, I think.
I think it's around that now. Yeah. Well, I can check, actually.
I'm done showing. Go to Commentary Magazine and subscribe. It's really great.
Yeah.
So lots of news, obviously, all of it bad because it's 2019. All bad things. Can we start with Alex Trebek? I don't know, when you guys saw a video announcement from Trebek saying, "Hey, Super Chipper, just want to talk to the Jeopardy community. I have stage 4 pancreatic cancer, but don't worry, I'm going to keep fighting." And I was just like, what? Mm-hmm. This is horrifying and terrible. And yeah. I don't know. It feels like the end of an era.
It is the end of an era. I mean, he is kind of a television institution. I mean, the show, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was originally one of those Merv Griffin shows.
Yes.
But he's been the host for so long. 1983, I think?
84. He took over the rejiggered version of Jeopardy. So it's like 35 years. Are you Jeopardy watcher? You strike me as a Jeopardy watcher.
Yeah. Well, especially when I was a kid, it would be on in the background while my mom was cooking dinner, and we'd all try to guess it. And I mean, there was something, I think what appeals to people about it, I was thinking about this after I saw his announcement, is that everybody on that show could be someone you know, right? Could be your neighbor, could be that really smart teacher you have. Normal people who actually were quite abnormal because they had this extremely interesting vat of knowledge that they could perform on demand. And the reason he was such a great host is that he didn't condescend to anyone who comes on that show, right? You have obviously mega nerds, you have goofballs, you have all this range of humanity on display, and he's always respectful, which I think is something that we will miss when he's no longer there.
I was trying to think, Jim, is there an example of somebody that long in a post who survives without recourse to like a catchphrase or something? I mean, in a weird way, his shtick was that there's no shtick. He's like the Brian Lamb of game show hosts.
Yeah, he's not Emeril Lagasse. It's not Bam, you know. He doesn't have
Richard Dawson come up here and lay one on me.
Come on down. Right. It's in everyone now, it's about making yourself into the brand. And his brand has been Jeopardy. And I think you raised this point in your fine newsletter, morning newsletter, redesigned and looking fantastic, by the way, where you, correct me if I'm wrong, you observe that unlike, or maybe you were quoting someone, if this was you or someone you quoted, but unlike a lot of these other people, he didn't view Jeopardy as a stepping stone to something that was, you know, Good Morning America or something bigger and better. Jeopardy was it for him.
He wasn't Michael Strahan. You know, like he was not like eyeing this as a, well, you know, I'm gonna go and become a serious newsman and do Good Morning America or something. It's like, hey, there's this thing. I'm really good at doing it. And so it gives people pleasure. And so I'm just going to do it really well for a very long time. Yeah. And I get the sense people don't want to do that anymore. Like, that doesn't seem like
they don't want to be journeyman
ambition.
You know,
yeah.
It's always onward and upward and hashtag hustle.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Even like, you know, like LeBron James. Like, I want to be a global icon. You know, like, instead of just like a
just be
basketball.
A basketball yeah. player.
You just be Michael Jordan and at total NBA points, you know?
Yeah.
You're a billionaire. It'll be fun. But your boss is a Jeopardy champion, John.
John Podhoretz,
right.
A 5-time Jeopardy champion, went to the Tournament of Champions mm-hmm. on Jeopardy, and I think Did he win a round in Tournament of Champions?
I don't know if he won a round. I'm not going to say whether he did or not because he'll correct me if I'm wrong. But yeah, no, he is an amazing Jeopardy.
Yeah, he went on. Nick Sweezy, who we worked with, was a 4-time Jeopardy champion. Came very close to making the 5 times, getting into the Tournament of Champions.
Tom Nichols.
Mm-hmm. It is weird that we know 3 people. I actually was thinking about this. So the show has run for 35 years. You have 3 people a day for 35 years. I wonder, what is the normal degree of separation from the average person in America with knowing somebody who was on the show?
Yeah. Hmm.
And I suspect it's probably only 1 or 2 degrees.
One of my grade school classmates, one of my groomsmen, his mom was on Jeopardy. And one of my grad school classmates was on Jeopardy, too. And he invited me to this invite-only trivia league called Learned League, which Kelly Torrance and I used to do. It's like a daily 5-question trivia thing. And, you know, a lot of like Carter Bays from How I Met Your Mother is on it. And Ken Jennings, who you think should take over for Alex
that
Trebek.
Brilliant.
Yes. You're suggesting.
Right. Do you agree with me that Ken Jennings is the only person who can save Jeopardy?
But yeah. he'd have to tone it down a little in terms of being a host means helping others as much as it means he's a performer right now, right? Yeah.
Well, see, I worry about this because I actually think that to succeed Alex Trebek, you cannot be Alex Trebek. In a way, you have to be your own. You nobody's going to do Alex Trebek better than Trebek did.
Right.
You have to do your own thing. And that's why I just love the Ken Jennings alpha nerd charm. I just find it astonishing.
And I think he probably would pick on contestants a little bit, like not in a mean way. I mean, I watched this clip where all 3 Jeopardy contestants missed every single question in a category about football. And Trebek was just mocking all of them because, you know, it's okay to mock the panel, but singling one person out, right, that was bad. I could see Jennings just kind of, because when he was on, I mean, he had that famous answer, what is a hoe? And yes, then there was the pause, right, and then there was the pause, and then Trebek got it and was just like, oh, he willingly did it to make a joke because he knew he was so confident he was going to win. If we could have things like that, you know, in a very un-Trebek way, I think he could be really the only person to save Jeopardy.
So I plug this in my newsletter. I will say it here because the Venn diagram of podcast listeners and Bulwark newsletter subscribers is not 100% circle. You should go. Have you guys read the Reddit Ask Me Anything with,
yes,
Ken Jennings?
Yes.
It's from 8 years ago. It is
hilarious.
An unbelievable piece of performance art. I mean, literally, one of the funniest things I've ever read. You can't believe that the guy is that together and that sharp. He's really... he's the best. And I hope that Trebek beats stage 4 pancreatic cancer. But even if he does, he's going to need to take some days off, and it would be great to have Ken Jennings sitting in that chair.
Well, one of the things that you pointed out in the newsletter this morning, which I think is really interesting, especially given his AMA that he did on Reddit, is that he called himself, and I can't say both words, but he called himself.
Yes, you can.
Yes, you can.
I can say he called himself Watson's bitch.
Yeah.
Because, you know, IBM artificial intelligence has played Jeopardy and won.
Beat him, Beat him soundly.
But this brought up a bigger point, which I think you're right to acknowledge, is that can we even have Jeopardy in a day and age where you can ask Siri or ask Alexa? Do we really need to store up that amount of information? And in some ways it's like playing a vinyl record to see human beings unaided by technology just remembering stuff.
Yeah.
I talked about this on a podcast we had. Geez, I'm kind of losing track of time. We've only been here a little over 2 months, but I mean, I remember, and you guys, I mean, are older than me, but having Encyclopedia Britannica at home. And one of the things that, you know, always kind of pisses me off, I'm not an expert in a ton of things, but I have, you know, had jobs in Congress and worked on things where I have more knowledge than an average person. And, you know, the thing about technology is everyone can just Google and find their answer or find an answer that comports with their worldview. And Jeopardy is, you know, a relic of an era where people actually had to earn this knowledge and remember it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's the audience is people who still appreciate that, as opposed to, you know, those stupid apps where that trivia app where you can win money every day, everyone plays,
I do believe it's actually in a weird way important because it turns out that actually holding on to discrete packets of knowledge is important. Like, even though you can offload great bits of this to computers, it is helpful to have these things at your fingertips in life. It is not an archaic skill that is no longer of any value. It is not like being a coal miner versus, you know, John Henry versus the steam engine, although it seems right. like that. And so it is important to have something like Jeopardy, which reinforces in the culture, hey, this thing is valuable. It's a valuable pursuit and a valuable thing to do with your time. I'll be very sad either way. And I hope that Trebek does okay. What is the other Easter egg, I wonder, we don't do show notes of any sort, but maybe one of the, certainly the top 10 funniest Saturday Night Live bits ever is the Celebrity Jeopardy episode with
Sean Connery.
So it's Daryl Hammond as Sean Connery.
Shuck it, Trebek.
I'll take the anal, what is it?
Anal rapist.
Anal rapist, please.
Planet Blue today, aren't we? No, it was horrible.
No, it isn't the anal rapist, is it?
All the categories were sort of horrifying things that they...
So it was, and then Norm MacDonald as right. Burt Reynolds, who writes his name Turd Ferguson. if we can find a link, we'll put the link in the show notes or something, but it is the best 7 minutes you will have today. And Will Ferrell playing Alex Trebek mm-hmm. in, with this sort of...
The pen is mightier. No, the rapists.
The rapist, yes. Therapists.
Yeah. So is the, oh, and the, then I'm and an album cover.
What is he?
An album cover.
Yeah.
Therapist.
Actually,
I'll take the rapist for $400.
Anal bum cover. That's what I was. I confused that and the rapist.
But SNL's Black Jeopardy skits are also hilarious too. Tom Hanks plays the MAGA guy.
Yeah. That was very, very, very good.
Very funny.
Maybe the only thing you've ever done to disappoint me, Christine, was not write the book about social media, which I spent like 9 years of my life like rubbing my hands together like a kid.
I've just finished a book and about to turn in the final draft, and there is a lot it's not specifically about social media, but it's about how technology is turning us into very unusual human beings. Let's put it that way.
I can't wait to.
So that's going.
Are you really just about finishing that, or am I going to spend another decade of my life?
I'm doing the notes. Yeah, it's long overdue, but I'm doing the final. I got all the edits back from my editor.
Excellent.
I could see a Christine Rosen book about social media doing some IRL trolling. That there would be no digital copies. There would be no audio books, and you would find some way to have.
There's an audio book, but it's on CDs.
Yes, CDs only.
Track. And it's on 8-track.
Yeah. Something that you couldn't digitize, and it wouldn't even show up in like Google Books.
I deliver it by carrier pigeon. If you order the book, it's delivered to your home.
So Facebook is pivoting again.
Oh boy,
they've pivoted from video to meaningful interactions to becoming like what you used to love about Facebook, just your friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and now they're pivoting again to encryption and privacy.
Right. So there's this big announcement, and I haven't finished reading. I read most of Zuckerberg's long statement about it. The cynical take is that after a year or so of extremely awful PR when it comes to Facebook and privacy, which we won't rehash, but I'm sure your listeners are aware of, Zuckerberg's pivot is to say, well, Facebook was the public square for many years, right? We've conquered the public square. Great job, Facebook. Except for all that genocide and Russian trolling. But anyway, so now we've heard your concerns about privacy. We want to respond. We're a responsive company. So now we want to be in your living room. So, of course, lots of people said, oh, wow, privacy, this is great. It'll just be the people I know and like. Okay, my original thought was, why would you want Mark Zuckerberg closer to you than he already is? And I think because they've integrated WhatsApp and Messenger, they're trying to integrate all of their services so that they can track you across all the platforms that Facebook now owns. The concern they're attempting to address, but with no specifics, with no timeline for when this will occur, and with no answer to questions like what will this mean for law enforcement if you have end-to-end encryption on some of these things. Without answering any of those questions, they're saying, oh, yes, privacy, we embrace it. Let's make this a more intimate service. Let's make it like Snapchat where you can get rid of messages. Let's have encryption, et cetera, et cetera. I'm, as you know, extremely cynical about Facebook and especially cynical about grand sweeping statements from Mark Zuckerberg. They've almost never panned out, and they almost always cover what his real pursuit is, which is market dominance. at this point, Facebook is the size of a huge country. They're talking about making their own currency, Bitcoin-like thing. That's in development.
Because there's cryptocurrencies are working out so well.
Well, right. But if you notice, he's very keen on going into segments of new markets and actually succeeding where others have failed. So I don't doubt that they will have success there. He wants to make, mobile service. Basically, Facebook is the internet for a lot of people in developing countries, right? Everything is done through that platform.
Yeah, and I would say, if I could pause you for a minute, people in America often don't realize that our experience of Facebook here is not what it is like in developing countries.
That's right.
Can I get you to spend 15 seconds on how Facebook has brought internet to...
Right. It's brought the internet to developing countries, but the price for the people who use it is that everything has to go through Facebook. So it's an extremely closed system, and so their only experience of the internet is via Facebook, which means if Facebook says, oh, hey, let's introduce, you're a small business person in a developing country. We have our own currency, and you can just so easy, and you can just, exchange
it's like
with
the company
people.
Store. It chips at the company
a, it
store.
It becomes a company store. It becomes the bank. It becomes many things. They're talking about drafting a constitution of Facebook values.
Then they're going to start offering loans.
Exactly. This behavior, the reason I think this is in some ways a PR move for Facebook is that it's very much targeted towards Western audiences, this privacy talk. That is not how they're conducting business in the rest of the world. So I would say keep your eye on the timeline if it's ever issued as to when all this, end-to-end encryption is going to be offered, when all of these privacy things are going to be allowed. Because we were talking earlier before the show, the real market in the West now is for the home, basically bringing these, I call it, it's a spy device, Alexa, all these other...
The portal.
Into your home so that it gets to pick up everything your kids are saying.
What could be wrong with having a little portal from your home into the Facebook mothership?
There you go.
I think you're right about end-to-end in the third world, because I have Facebook Lite installed on my phone, which is the app that they've made for the third world. It's under 1 megabyte, as opposed to having to download a 500-megabyte Facebook app and then the Messenger app. Or I don't use WhatsApp, but instead of taking up half of a gig, I just have 1 megabyte on my phone because I don't use Facebook all that often, and it's hard to fully encrypt and include all of these other sorts of things on an app that's so small. Mm-hmm. But it'll be interesting because they have 2G internet in Botswana and places in sub-Saharan Africa or whatnot. But that's, you bring more internet there, and isn't he working on blimps that have internet or something, or it's bringing low cost
Wi-Fi
to places. Global domination.
He's a total humanitarian.
although I would say of the big tech companies, so of Amazon, Google, Facebook, Apple, which of those do you think is in the weakest position to sort of rule people's lives 20 years from now? I would say Facebook. No?
I think it depends on if you mean all people worldwide, or you mean people in the U.S. or Western Europe. No, I would say Apple, actually.
Really?
Because they don't have the portal. They don't have the they're not trading on private information in the same way that all the other companies are, and where the money all is. Look at iPhone sales, which are year to year not doing as well as they used to. They have to innovate. If they innovate, that could change. But I would say it would be Apple that would be at the end.
So you say they don't have a portal, but they, I'm holding the phone.
Right. Yes.
And I'm not going to say that I'm a conspiracy theorist who is convinced that my iPhone is always listening to me through the microphone.
You should assume
regardless.
It's always listening to you.
But I would say the number of times in which I turn to my wife and say, we need X from Amazon. I have to remember to order that. And then 4 minutes later, I say, I'll just do it now. And I pull my phone out and I pull the Amazon app out and I start typing, and it auto completes the thing I have just said out loud. Is shocking to me. And so I don't want to sound like a crazy tinfoil hat person, the phone is listening
to
us. I love
tinfoil hat JBL.
Have you guys come up with some A-B tests and you talk about things that you would never buy?
Something obscure. right.
You know.
Yeah, I don't know. Jim, what do you, I mean, of those four, the four or five companies I named, who would you say is best positioned to sort of, if there is going to be total consolidation under the circle, mm-hmm. essentially, who is best positioned?
I would split it evenly between Apple and Facebook. Apple, because, as Christine alluded to, while they do have a portal, your iPhone's iPhone-specific technology, FaceTime and other things, doesn't work with my Android.
Yes.
Everyone in my family has Apple, and they have these big group chats, and I'm happy not to be on them. So it is like planned obscurity, and I'm a reluctant Team Android defender because I just don't want to get on it. But because they have no way to integrate it, and because their devices are so expensive, you know, people in Botswana aren't getting the iPhone 10 or X or whatever right. it's called. Right. They might be getting, you know, reconditioned iPhone 3s, you know, and those are still probably
China.
Yeah, very expensive. Yeah. Facebook, I think, unless they diversify, you know, is one huge disaster away. I mean, everyone after the whole privacy thing, and I think their privacy is sort of like a fig leaf. Americans don't really care about privacy as much as they say they do in the polls. Because I know Christine Rosen, I know people who truly care about privacy and are rightly concerned about it. But I see all these other people. I'm quitting Facebook. I'm leaving. This is enough. Cambridge Analytica, the Mercers, I'm leaving. 2 months later, they're back. And then they're taking stupid polls like, what kind of dog are you? And when you do that, most people don't know. You are basically agreeing to give your information to someone who's probably in Latvia. This isn't, I mean, the people don't create algorithms that you connect with Facebook to Photoshop your face onto a dog, you know, just for shits and giggles. They're not doing it for free. They're collecting your information, and that's what Cambridge Analytica did. Yep. I'm not an apologist for what they did, but, you know, the same sorts of people who are complaining and saying, this is horrible, are like the same idiots who are like, what Friends character are you? You know?
Yeah. Now, the difference, I mean, one of the differences is that people pay money to Amazon and Apple and to a large extent Google, right? They're paying for services. I've always believed that Facebook is the type of thing that people could walk away from to a near competitor pretty painlessly.
Look at MySpace.
Yeah. I mean, for just if all you are is a media type platform and a publisher, then having an alternative and leaving the one thing and integrating your life into another thing is actually pretty simple.
But they're buying up all the decent competitors.
Well, that's the real question.
The problem,
and then
right?
the question
that
becomes, is this anti-competitive behavior? Mm-hmm. You know, are they going to get broken up? I mean, I believe, that from talking with my friends out in the Valley, that all of these companies are basically convinced that regulation is coming no matter what.
Right.
They are no longer fighting to stop being regulated. And
they're Philip Morris.
They know it's coming.
Let's preserve our market share and make it barriers to entry too high for new entrants.
And I think they all think that that's coming. And I don't know. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm awfully happy to not be on Facebook. I was talking with somebody yesterday who has a 10-year-old, somebody who listens to this podcast and will get mad at me, so I won't use her name, who has a 10-year-old girl who has an iPhone and has an Instagram account. And I was like, what?
No.
She's like, well, it's locked. We monitor it.
And sure you do.
And that's not the problem.
Not the Finsta.
It's a gateway. Right. I mean, oof.
Anyway, so, yes.
Well, so this is my other new... We were emailing about this earlier. My beef with this argument that, you know, Republicans are obsessed with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example. But the reason she is so frustrating, first of all, it's not because people are obsessed with her. It's because she's one of the first national politicians that was raised on this stuff, right? She's a social media politician. She's all over Instagram. She's all over Twitter. She's all over Facebook. And she is... Exactly. She's such a cautionary tale as a result, because the stream of consciousness talking about policy while cooking soup. And then when people say, well, actually, you're wrong. And then she overreacts and says, well, I was, you know, I'm don't know enough yet. And you're just obsessed with me. And I feel like she's extremely skillful at using it. It gets her a lot of attention. It gets her a lot of followers. But the danger is the sacrifice of image for depth, the sacrifice of seriousness and patience and policymaking for the display.
Have you looked at American politics recently, Christine?
I know. Because but I just think this is going to make it worse.
You say it's a cautionary tale, but I wonder if it isn't actually a primer. I mean, the real question is, does somebody like AOC pay a price for the downsides. So all the downsides you say are real. The downsides of, you know, makes her less serious. She just sort of pops off. She isn't really accountable for anything she says. Are those downsides real in terms of they're going to have electoral consequences and political consequences for her? Or has the culture just become habituated to all of that?
Well, I think it depends. I think the answer to the first question lies in the hands of Nancy Pelosi, right? The question of how real power is exercised in Congress and whether she will have be given platforms to pursue her constituents' interests. I mean, let's not forget, a very small number of people elect this person to Congress, and she's been given a national platform on a lot of serious issues like the environment, which only a very small number of Americans elected her to do. So I think that question is in Nancy Pelosi's hand. I would say there's already a pretty serious downside to this, the glibness of political culture that plays out on social media. We're seeing it with the Ilhan Omar anti-Semitism row, right? Because if you have enough people, you know, oh, just asking questions on Twitter, and oh, well, maybe something she says is true, and oh, what about ism? Because look at the Republicans. There's a way in which the original question disappears. The original question is, has she consistently made anti-Semitic remarks? Yes, she has. There is no doubt about it. But social media, the pace of social media in particular, and the number of voices piling on, including extremely powerful people in Congress and in the Senate, and just, you know, any old guy on the street, it waters down the focus, and the focus shifts from where it should be, which is, should this person have a seat on a committee that deals with foreign policy when she's an obvious anti-Semite? That gets washed away, and then the infighting starts. And I think that is a real downside for all of us, if our political culture is
so, if it gets washed away, and I think it does, I think it's right. I mean, the proximate danger is like just with this one congresswoman, right?
Right.
But the downstream danger is that if this is okay for her,
right,
then it's basically just normalized,
right?
And this is
absolutely,
again, this is what I'm saying. Yeah. I wonder if all of this stuff is normalized so that nobody's going to pay a price for any of this stuff ever again,
or it becomes expected. And that's kind of my worry as someone who worked for
performative, right? It'll become performative.
Right.
You have to be
who worked for lawmakers, and I had two very good bosses. One that I think you know, the world of, and one I, you know, kind of butted heads with, but respected very much. And we had to force a smartphone on him for security reasons when he became part of the leadership. If everyone is expected to basically bring constituents into all of their lives, all the parts of their lives, whether they're making soup or in a car and all these other sorts of things, that will crowd out people we should want in government too. Mm-hmm. And then of course there are risks to being flippant and commenting on all of these different things where, you know, if you feel compelled to talk about it, you're always going to get stuck in a minefield somewhere that you didn't anticipate. And you know, I worry that if we expect this from everyone, we're just going to get a lot of people who should be in elected office just look at it and go, yeah, you know, I didn't sign up to be an Instagram actor.
Well, and there's a huge contradiction built into that constant performance, and we see this with AOC, right? She was upset because people were questioning the role her boyfriend plays in her office, and was he paid? Did he have an email address? There was this little controversy about that.
Yeah.
She got very, rather than engage the controversy, she took to Twitter and was like, oh, this is terrible because I didn't think my private life and the people who I, you know, my family and my home should not be part of the fodder. Well, you know, a few months ago, she was posing in her apartment with her boyfriend for Vanity Fair. So it's like and then posted that on Instagram. It's like, look, you invite the world into your personal space. The drawback is they're going to keep asking questions about that. Do you actually live in this apartment?
Yeah.
Is your boyfriend being paid? Well, is he a public servant? Like, these are legitimate questions because she is a public servant and she's opened up her private life and used her private life as political, as a powerful political tool. And that's fine, but you've got to, with that comes things you might not like.
Well, then photographers from unnamed publications will, like, you know, wait outside of your place and take pictures.
Well,
and
that's
then
just creepy.
People will write stories about, you know, the types of tenants who live there and whatnot. And there's also a weird obsession angle. I mean, as long as politics has been around and there have been celebrities, there have always been people who are obsessed, right? And obsession is always a bad thing, whether it's I hate this person and I, you know, wish them harm, or I love this person, I'm going to murder their bunny and put it in a, you know, in their stove. When you start like revealing what your house looks like, where you live, all these other sorts of things, it really kind of opens up, I think, a whole scary potential future for, I mean, people didn't know where the senator I worked for lived.
No, but the pseudo-intimacy that it cultivates online, people think they know these people. They think they know her if they watch her making soup in her kitchen. I mean, you do. And that's that is a huge appeal for her, especially for younger voters. But it also then is perhaps a level of intimacy we shouldn't want or need.
Then someone moves into that building. You know, they know they can tell what kind, where it is, and you know, weird people find out where the outside of the building it's on. I'm going to live in the Navy Yard in this building, and then we're going to be best friends. And then I mean, just
very single white female.
Yeah, it's
get
weird.
The same haircut.
and I think after the Weekly Standard closed, I wonder what Christine Rosen's up to. I wonder what Andy Ferguson or Matt Labash are up to. And I can't because none of you are on social media, so I have to call you or I have to email you. And if we get rid of that sort of, it's not intimacy in a way, but like if you just get rid of all of that and everyone is always sharing everything on social media, there's no mystery left. Mm. You know, there's like interactions are fake. Oh, what did my friend that I haven't talked to in 12 years did? Boop, boop. I know everything about their life now. Cool.
For all of the downside risk that you talked about politically, Christine, I would say this. I suspect that she will be the single most coveted endorsement for all of the Democrats running for president, possibly more so than Obama.
I hate to say it, but that's probably...
I mean, Obama brings a list with him. Likely. And so, you know, if you get Obama's endorsement, you get his fundraising list. But just as a matter of moving voters and generating excitement, I think that she is pretty... Kingmaker is too much of a... I'll say this. If she were to jump in with Bernie...
Well, she volunteered for Bernie before, right?
So if she were to jump in on the Bernie campaign, I believe that his odds go from, say, 2 in 5 to 3 in 5.
Oof.
So, I mean, you know, it's powerful, and I don't see a whole lot of drawbacks except among people like us who... You know, think that
actually read the Green New Deal.
Who are bothered by the same stuff from Trump and Trump's tweets.
Right.
You know, I mean,
exactly.
You know, we think these things are ludicrous, but the voters don't. The problem is them. The problem is the people, as always. All right. Well, that's all I had for today. Do you guys have anything else you wanted to talk about?
No.
All right. Well, for Jim Swift and Christine Rosen of Commentary Magazine and me, Jonathan Last at The Bulwark, we'll be back tomorrow to do this all over again.